Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor. Now these laws of Shemitah are introduced by saying that Hashem spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai. Question comes up, why was it necessary to mention that these laws were given on Har Sinai? We would assume that the entire Torah was given in Har Sinai. And Rashi says, quotes the Chazal, that it comes to tell us that just like these laws were given from Sinai, therefore all the other laws were also given from Sinai. So why does he decide to tell us that at this point? And what is the question? So Hirsch says a very interesting thought. He says the last part of chapter 24, which deals with the Mekalel, a Ben Isha Yisraelis, when the son of a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father went out and he got into a fight with a born Jew, and he cursed the name of God. So they brought him to Moshe, and it says that Moshe put him in like in a jail, Bamishmor, in order to find out what the result of what punishment would be there. So God speaks to Moshe. He says, take out the Mekalel outside, and he should be stoned. He should be stoned. Then if you notice, he speaks about a person who curses Hashem. In 17, this is just something I'll mention, he speaks about a person who slays another man and goes into the laws of one person causing damage to the life or to the property. And then in verse 23, it says that Moshe spoke to Hashem. He took out the Mekalel, they took him out, and they did that which was told from Hashem that they should do to the one who cursed him. So now Hirsch says that after he had this chapter, obviously something was wrong. Moshe didn't know what to do with him. Now, didn't he learn all the laws on Sinai? If the entire Torah was given in Sinai, then what is the idea that he was placed in prison until they would become aware what to do with him? So he says, to oppose that the idea, one would say, if this law was given so vaguely, this very important law that a person is cursing the name of God, it's extremely important to me, it's unimaginable. And if such a severe law was given so vaguely and incompletely that when the necessity for it actually arose, so it had to be explicitly told what to do, so how much more laws that really were not that cardinal, we'll say, or that great an impact, and it really only would become absolutely irrelevant once they were in Israel. So those laws surely, we would think, we're not given on Sinai. So therefore, it felt necessary to tell us immediately after the chapter of the Mekalel that the laws of Shemitah in all of their details were given here in Sinai, because it says, Bahar Sinai Lemor, that God spoke to Moshe at that time and gave him all these laws. So we say that refers to all the laws of the Torah. So then the question is, why was the law of cursing God's name, why wasn't that given in all details if all the other laws were given in details? So Hirsch writes the following, maybe the Torah did not wish beforehand even to suggest the possibility of such a crime, because this is the gravest of all grave sins occurring amongst the people of God. And as a matter of fact, it was only committed, he says, by one who was Egyptian in character. So the Torah did not want to even picture, envision that something like this could happen. Therefore, they weren't specific in the detail until it happens. But the entire Torah, which, like the laws of Shemitah and everything else, that was given totally. This is the way Hirsch interprets the interpretation of Ma'elum is Sinai, to teach us just like this is Sinai, that would also be Tolei Bisina. Now, I mentioned the previous chapter, 24, and if you notice, the structure of the chapter leaves something for question, because it tells us what happened, and they put him in Bemishmor in the jail, And then it goes off and it says, you're not allowed to curse God's name, you'll be put to death. And then immediately goes over if you smite another person or if you take the life of his property. And then it relates back to say that they stoned him the way Hashem spoke to Moshe. For some reason, they interspersed in the middle of the law of the events of the Mekalel cursing God's name about hitting a fellow man, killing a fellow man, and then back to cursing Hashem's name. Why was it put in the middle? Should have finished the first subject, and then if it was necessary, the other laws. Why did they interspace this in the middle? So there's a very interesting lesson that we could learn from this. But the answer is very simple. There are some people that think that they don't have to accept religion. We could appreciate this, that you could separate totally church and state or in school. For example, you could bring up a nice law-fearing, ethical, moral, social conscious citizen in a total environment which is totally a vacuum and there is no religious mention, there's no mention of God, there's no teaching at all. That means you could deny, you could be an agnostic, an atheist, whatever it is, yet you will respect your fellow man. So that really is not true, because in individual cases, of course, it could be in individual cases, we're not tested. But when you're speaking, if you just look at the masses that are what's going on now in the world or in America, in fact, the Post had from Rabbi Jacobowitz an interview. And he emphasized this idea of what the result of a total separation of church and state is. I mean, the fact is that I remember when I went to public school in the first and second grade, they used to say a prayer every morning or whatever. I didn't say the prayer, but I mean, there would be a prayer. There would be the name of God, at least. There was some kind of an aura of religion that you found. But this is almost like in communism, that you're not allowed to mention God's name in a public building. So you have people that are growing up totally missing this moral, ethical teaching of religion. And therefore, what happens is you have a bunch of uncivilized, could be cultured, but uncivilized, and there are no restraints. So he says that this is really the idea that the Torah wants to tell us here, that what will lead for the person to go ahead and to kill a fellow person, a fellow individual. It should be a logical thing. But if a person has totally cast off his respect and the restraints of religion to the degree that he can curse the name of God, and therefore we're commanded against that, in the meantime, right next to that, they put in the idea of killing your fellow man, because there is a very intimate association between that. One who does the first will also end up doing the second. So it's part of that chapter. It's part of that lesson. That's why it's put in at that point. And I think that's an important message, which is really very relevant in our day. So now, what is this law? The law, basically the law of Shemitah. It says, Ki soveyu al ha'aretz, in sentence 2, V'shofso ha'aretz Shabbos Lashem, and the land keeps the Sabbath unto God. And all the commentaries speak on this issue. What is the importance or the implications of the law of Shemitah? But in reality, the answer is really given to you right there in the way Hirsch says it in one sentence. Now, when the people came into Eretz Yisrael, the first 14 years, they didn't have to worry about the laws of Shemitah at all. Because the 7 years that they were involved and occupied themselves to conquer the land, that's called Seven Shekivshu. And then after that, there was Sheva Shechilku. They took them 7 years till they divided the land into the tribes and so on. So with the 15th year, they began the Shemitah cycle. And the 21st year was the first Shemitah year. So that was the 7th year. So they were in Israel 21 years when they had the first Shemitah year. So Shabbos Bereshis, really, so the idea is that what the Shabbos is in relationship to a man, between man and God, so the 7th year is also in relationship from the land. That means the first Shabbos is the acknowledgement of God as the creator and the master of the world, the creator of the world. The second is more detailed, that it's the acknowledgement that Hashem is the owner and master of the land. before you conquered the land, before you divided the land. So then, obviously, you don't need a reminder, because even the land itself was divided, and Talmud discusses how it was divided. It was divided in a with the Urim V'Tumim and with a Novi. So in a sense, there was the divine sign of God involved in the division of the land. In the war to conquer the land, there's surely no question that they had the Hashgacha of Hashem. But after working the land, we'll say, for 6 years, then by then, the person already begins, as the Chinuch explains, to think that he's the Odon al Ha'oretz, that he is the master over this land. So then it became necessary for the message of Shemitah, that for 1 year the land has to remain without the person working on it.
It is that man should not convince himself he is the master of his work, which is also important. Man shouldn't convince himself that he is the master of the work. Now, what he says is the general rule is that one is not permitted to act in his field in any way as the owner, but all his produce should be ownerless and available to all, that even the simplest Jew may take it. The Torah commanded this mitzvah to tell us that all types of governing or ownership in this lower world should be annulled in regard to working the land, so that man should consider that neither governing nor ownership mean anything, since everything belongs to the master of all. So they all go around the idea that it belongs to Hashem. Again, this goes back to Hirsch's original statement that the personality of God really is that which rules and that which provides us, what does he use here, the basis for all rights of men. Now, you could take this theme and look at it from many ways. The personality of God is the basis for all rights of men. And the various comments that are made by the Mefarshei Torah, by the commentaries, all go around this theme. So we have the idea to show that God is the master of the earth, that God is the master of the work, that man shouldn't become enslaved in a drudgery and realize that he has a higher mission, that man should also deal benevolently with his fellow man, realizing, as we see, that that fellow man is also a Tzelem Elohim, and he has to deal with him in this fashion. So these are some of the reasons that are presented. Now, there are many reasons. I just give one more. Yeah. There's a Meshech Chochmah. There's a 6 years of Shemitah cycle when one may grow crops parallel the 6 days of creation. So the third and the 6 days of creation, when you look in the Torah, in Bereshis, when it speaks about the creation on the third day, that's why people want to move on Tuesday, because it says Kito twice. And in the sixth year, it's repeated twice. So he says that's why in the Shemitah cycle, in the third year and in the sixth year, there's a law that a person every year has to give tithes. He gives the Levi what we call Maaser. The first and the second year of the Shemitah cycle, he gives a tithe to the Levi. He also sets aside a tithe so that he can spend that money in Israel, which in a sense is also a sabbatical idea. Miser Shem, the money accumulates and he has to spend it in Israel. But the third year, instead of taking the Miser Shem, he has to give Miser Oni, a tithe to poor people. And the sixth year of the cycle, 3-3, instead of giving Miser Shani, again, he has to give the tithe to the poor people. So the 2 days of creation in which we find that God used the expression Kito, it was good. So when it came to the Miseris later, the Miser Oni that was given to the poor person was also applied to the third and the sixth day of creation. So this is another comparison from the laws of Shemitah. Now, there isn't time, but I want to go through, just to give you an idea of some of the laws that are mentioned in Behar that deal with man's... There's first the laws of the counting of the Yevil. Then there's a law that you're not allowed to fool a person when it comes to money. This is what we call onor, that the idea of not to fool somebody else when it comes to mekach and memkar It says, when you sell anything to your fellow man, or you buy anything from him, you shall not wrong one another. Now you'll say, this is a common thing. What does this have to do with Sinai? But that's business. I mean, they don't even understand what you're doing, what you're saying to them. So to appreciate how important this love of Alteinu Isha Safi by the personality, again, of God has to come into this, is something which is very important in our modern day market. Then also, Leisenu Isha Sami, shouldn't hurt the feelings of one another, but you shall fear your Lord, for I Hashem am your Lord. So it repeats again. Why does it have to say that you shall fear God? Because at times a person, Rashi says, can say something that appears to be an innocent remark. In reality, he maliciously says it because he wants to cause someone anguish or pain, but he doesn't really want that person to know that he causes that was his intent. Person can't prove it. I'll say something to you innocently, right? But my intent was that. Now you have no way of knowing what my intent is. But it says that God knows. And Hashem. So that's why, again, you put in the personality of God dealing with that. Now, how great, you know, the laws of insulting someone. Now Allah brings down that insulting someone is worse than cheating in financially. Because money can always be returned. But pain caused by words cannot be erased. In fact, and how many people everybody is guilty of it. Even in the time of the Talmud, you find in the Yerushalmi brought down a story that the Pinchas Ben-Yoyer was once traveling with a group of his disciples to approach the yeshiva. When they came to the Ginoi River, which is above, they saw that they would, the Ginoi River, they saw that they would be unable to cross it because of it was very turbulent. So Reb Pinchas Ben-Yoyer said, Ginoi, Ginoi, speaking to the river, why are you preventing me from going to the yeshiva? Immediately it says the river divided in two. Now after he crossed, his disciples asked him if they could take the chance too. So he said, whoever knows that he has never insulted or harmed another Jew in his life can come across and he won't be harmed. So actually were all righteous men, but they were still considered, these were Tanoim, students of Pinchas Ben-Yoyer, they were still considered unworthy for these miracles, to occur. And again, you know, the famous story, I'm sure you've heard that, Shem Gamliel told his servant Tevi, he says, go out to the marketplace and buy some food that's good. So Tevi went and he returned with the tongue. Afterwards, Shimon said to Tevi, go and buy some food that's bad. So he came back again with another tongue. So he says, what are you doing? So he says, well, I told you, yes, and I told you good, it's tongue. I told you bad, it's tongue. He says, from the tongue come good and can come bad. It depends. So when the tongue is good, there's nothing better. But when the tongue is bad, there's nothing worse. And then, when your brother grows poor, and he doesn't have any way to continue in business, right? When he is with you, you shall uphold him. So now, what is the idea? Now the Rambam says that this is the highest level of charity, because what you're doing is giving someone, giving him a loan or something, or making him a partner, and in that way he won't have to ask for charity. In a sense, this new idea of this chapter 11 of the bankruptcy laws are basically built on that also. Instead of a company going bankrupt, there is such an idea. Now, if you remember a number of years ago, there was a big turmoil in this country. Iacocca wanted to rescue Chrysler. So there was a question, should they declare bankruptcy and go out of business? Or a loan at that time by the government to certain conditions would help Chrysler get on its feet, maybe 10 years ago. So the government gave the loan, and obviously Chrysler became an important part of the economy. Now the other option would have been that if they would not have given the loan, because perhaps why should the government be in the business of giving loans at some point? So what would have happened? It would have brought about tragedy for thousands of people, would have lost their positions, and a big institution, or in an economic sense, would have been lost. This is the idea that they came in also with laws of bankruptcy. So this was a Torah approach, that rather than having a person, say, become a no'aman, So, you know, somebody went collecting money for someone else, collecting for his brother that's paralyzed, can't move, and he's collecting. Somebody finally, after giving him, he was a blister peddler, so then he finally started screaming at him. We found out you don't even have a brother, so what are you collecting? So he says, and if I would have had a brother and he'd be paralyzed, you'd be happy. Was gay the love that I don't have a paralyzed brother. The idea is, you know, a person comes to ask money. So, I mean, you could give him money to help him keep himself above water. No, I only give charity. Charity, and you want me to become an Alman. If I'm drowning, then you will give me money. So the Torah recognizes this, but again, this is something which has the personality, as we say, of God. Also, the idea where it says in 46, where it speaks here of servants, it says, "Ba'achechem b'nei Yisrael leisir debei beforach," that if you have a servant, another Jew, you should never rule overbearingly. Now, this speaks that you have an Eved Ivri, a Hebrew servant. Now, the law is that this servant, it's forbidden to give this servant special type of work. For example, just picture you have a servant, an Eved Ivri, and you tell him, I want you to hoe the lawn or mow the lawn or dig the backyard until I return. All right, so what's wrong with that? That's no good, because he has to give him a limit. He has to say, for example, I want you to fix the lawn till 2 o'clock. So then he knows what he's doing. He has a certain position. It's almost like you're hiring somebody for a specific job. But the fact that you're saying, I want you to go do this till I come back. So that shows that he's like a servant that doesn't really mean anything. He doesn't have his own esteem. You're taking away a person. For example, sometimes you say that you see a guy standing around doing nothing. So you don't want him to just stand doing nothing. You're paying him. So you give him something to do. If he's your Eved Ivri, you're not allowed to do that. Even if it was a light task, dust around the furniture. If you're only doing it because you can't see him standing there doing nothing. Again, this breaks down the dignity of the person. Now, we don't have this Eved Ivri concept. We don't have now because the law of Eved does not apply now. You can't have an Eved Ivri now. But the Chinuch says, for example, if you have a maid in your house, a Jewish maid, so you also have to be careful not to treat her in this overbearing manner, because although she's not a slave, but the same logic and the same idea is there, that you're not supposed to subjugate a fellow man. He said, bring down an interesting story from Reb Shraga Frank. He was the father-in-law of some great rabbis. From Reb Yisrael Epstein, actually also the third son-in-law that he had was also a famous person, Rabbi Shechtel Kramer, Rabbi Rudiman's his father-in-law was also one of the son-in-laws of this Reb Shraga Frank. Shraga Frank was known by everybody. He was was a big gevir, and he supported everybody and so on. So there were some very prominent guests who came to visit him. So he rang a bell for the maid to come and serve tea, but she didn't appear. So he rang a few more times, and she didn't appear. So one of the guests mentioned that if he were stricter with his servants, he would get better service. So he replied with a smile that this gives me happiness, because I'm always afraid that perhaps I'll be too overbearing, you know, and she'll be afraid and I'll be violating this law. But when I see that she doesn't fear me, he says, it's very comforting, because it shows that I'm not violating this prohibition. So again, this is dealing, even in an instance of dealing with another person ethically. All of this is Bahar Sinai, is all based in Har Sinai, because not only do we have to believe in God, that the Torah was given to Moshe to make a statement, work the field, you'll get 3 years' produce, but you also have to believe in Hashem in order to deal with your fellow man in this fashion, in order to help your fellow man before he needs help. All of these things have to do with the belief, with the personality of Hashem, that everything was given in Har Sinai. And if we think that we can separate that, I think that society has shown us how totally interwoven and dependent one is on another.
Now, this is not a very simple thing for one to fulfill. You know, we just go by and especially, well, now we do have the idea of Shomrei Shviz. We do have the idea of Shemitah. Shemitah is involved even in our day. Yovel is not involved in our day. Yovel, you need the majority of the people on the land. In fact, when you look at the structure of the Psukim, it says, Sheishonim Tizra Sodecho. It speaks about the Shemitah, and it speaks there in the individual, if you notice. Sheishonim Tizra Sodecho, V'sheishonim Tizmor Karmecho. 6 years you should plant, and 6 years you should prune. Now, when it's speaking about the yoke, so there it uses the expression plural, lo sizreu velo siktzeru. So from then some say that the pasuk alludes to the fact that Yovel is really different than Shemitah. By Yovel, plural, meaning you need the majority of the people to be on the land of Israel in order that the Yovel should apply. Bisman Sherov Yisrael Aleha. And by Shemitah we learn out as individuals are there. So they say this can be alluded to by the difference in the terms used. By Shemitah the Pasuk speaks in the singular, individual, meaning that every person has this obligation. When he speaks about Yovel, he already uses the plural, that it's the total community has to be on the land. But can you just picture a person who is a large landowner and he has to walk by the land at all times and see the land remaining just laying like this? It's very difficult to imagine such a thing. Now, there is a medrash in Tehillim that describes the sacrifice that is involved. It says there, Borchu Hashem, going on the passage in Tehillim, which reads that blessed God, Malachov, like his angels, Giborei Koach, those who possess such great strength, Eise Dvoro, to fulfill his words, Lishmoa Bekol Davor, to listen Bekol Dvoro in the voice and the command of God. So Rabbi Yitzchak said that who are we extolling and describing the strong determination and allegiance that the people have? These are the people who are Shomrei Shviz. These are the people who have taken to keep Shviz. Because, he says, Benoik Sheba'elam, the world, we know the custom is that a person could do a mitzvah for one day. He'll do a mitzvah with dedication for one day. He'll do it, we'll say, for 1 week. He'll do it for 1 month. But Shema L'chol Yemeis HaShona, a person could stand that strong and resolute in an entire year. And here you have a person who goes out every day and sees his fields laying bare, not producing. He sees his vineyards not being taken care of. And he remains silent. Yeshloch gibor chayel godel mizeh. He have a greater valiant soldier than this individual. So really we see from here that the Torah likes them to angels. It says, Borchu Hashem Malachov. They're angels because really they have to have the strength and the determination of an angel. But they're even greater than the angels. Why? Because we know by an angel they have no Yetzer Hara. So you just tell them once and that's their mission. So the angel will do what he has to. But a person, like the Chazal tell us, Halavai, let it only be that 2 times telling him should be sufficient. So it comes out that you have a very strong Yetzer Hara by Shemitah, especially when there's such sums of money involved. Even so, these people are girded with strength, gird themselves with strength to be like Malachim, but they're even greater than Malachim. This is a certain capacity, we'll say, that the Jew has, which is extolled. In the same vein we find the Gemara speaks about, before Shavuos, the Gemara speaks about the Bnei Yisrael who said, Nase v'nishma. They were just like the angels in a sense, that they were prepared, Nase, we will do, and then we will understand. That's the same idea, because the Shemitah concept cannot really be appreciated just by thinking about it and by intellectual. Because for intellectual reason, you'll have to have 1,000 terutzim in. So you have to have strong emunah. You have to have very strong faith. And therefore, that's the strength of Naseh, and then V'nishma. We'll do it because Hashem wants us to do it. So if you take a see, when you really see people, even Bizman Hazeh and Ajay, who keep the Shemitah, so you really have to look at them indeed as being Shomrei Shvi'is and the sacrifice that they have within themselves, an inner strength, which is, you know, because it's good betoken and betoken. We always have good betoken for somebody else. It's always really a good betoken, like the Dubna Magid. Dubna Magid says, and a little bit further in the Pasuk in 35, which says there, Chiyomucho Chicha, like when your brother becomes poor, Mota Yodo Imach, and he stretches out for help, Vechazaktabo, you're supposed to help him. You're supposed to help him. Actually, if you look at that verse for a moment, it speaks here about the social obligations and responsibilities that a Jew has. So if you'll note, it says there, if your brother becomes poor and he stretches out his hand to you, Vechazaktabo, so he's a family member of yours, a fellow Jew, Vechazaktabo, so you have to give him a special support. In fact, it says that even 4 or 5 times if you helped him, meaning before he gets to the point that you need charity, that you have to help him live, help him control his destiny by strengthening him, he'd be able to earn his own living. And it says that even if you helped him or you loaned money to him, we'll say that he could remain self-supporting even 4 or 5 times, you should still do that. That's the idea of Echazaktabo. Then it says, Ger v'seishov, a stranger and a sojourner, v'chayim moch. You should also give him the opportunity to live. That means to help him that he should be able to exist. Now it's interesting here, the Ger v'teishov doesn't speak about a proselyte. A proselyte is called a chicha. He is considered to be your brother, so therefore the previous law, v'chazaktabo, applies to him. But Ger v'teishov, we mean here, is the person who lives in the land, meaning that he is a Noahite. There is a movement now that you call Noahite movement. And a person, he hasn't entirely adopted the Jewish nationality, but he renounced idolatry, and he accepted all the Noahite laws of the duties of mankind. So this person acquires the right to live in Israel. He is a Ger Teshuv. So that's the one that the Pasuk is telling you, that Ger V'Teshuv V'Chai Imoch, that you have an obligation to see that the Ger V'Teshuv is able to exist. Now, you don't have the same degree that you would have to your brother, we'll say, that's a little bit V'Chazaktabo, but here we do have the idea of Ger V'Teshuv. Now, the next Pasuk where it says, Al tikach me'ito neshech v'sarbis. You shouldn't take from him any usury, meaning you shouldn't take what we call ribis. V'yoreisa melekecha v'chai ochicha imoch. Here when it says v'chai imoch, yoreisa melekecha means you should fear Hashem. V'chai imoch, let him live with you. Now here it puts in the word ochicha, your brother. That means that you're not allowed to loan for money to a Jew. A person who is a citizen, like we said, you're allowed to loan for money. That's why it says here, Ochicha Imoch. Now, what is the idea? You know, the world jumps on this like another Jew. I mean, the whole world loans money for money. We all do it in a permitted fashion. But that's acceptable. That, well, obviously you loan money for money, just like you rent somebody a house to live in. So you'll rent somebody some money. So Hirsch explains this very interesting way. He says, we have already in Shmos, where that's the source, worked out in full detail the Jewish conception of the prohibition of taking interest on loan. He says, there we showed that the Torah in no wise looks on interest as morally wrong. It's not morally wrong. Otherwise, it would not forbid with equal solemnity the paying of interest as it does the taking of interest. It wouldn't be a religious point if it would be basically a moral wrong. So the moral wrong would not apply to the borrower. It would apply to the lender. It wouldn't apply to the one who needs the money and borrows it. What could he never do? He'd gladly take the money. Yet we say he has the same violation as the one who lends him the money. So it seems to be not the moral wrong of asking for a profit for your money, but based on a certain religious concept or belief. And therefore, if it's a religious purpose, then obviously both participants would be equally culpable and they would both be a violation. And secondly, it would not really permit, if we look at the sentence, it says here, v'chayimoch, right? And that's morally correct. If 36, taking neshech, would be morally wrong, then why does it put in v'chay ochicha imoch? Then it should say the same v'chay imoch, that even a ger and a tosha of a citizen subject of the state, you shouldn't be permitted. But we know if he's not Jewish, a brother, you are permitted. So obviously he goes in and he shows, obviously there's nothing wrong. I could give you a good, I mean, if I have money laying around, I could buy a house and rent out the house. I could buy items and sell the items for a profit. So what's wrong if I rent you the money to use? What's the difference? I mean, why is it morally wrong? So he says, but when you look at it, I'm going to skipping. He says, when you look at it from the Jewish point of view, however, what Judaism, or one who's obligated to live, you know, and performs the mitzvahs, the money is not absolutely our own property. It is only conditionally ours. Because Hashem, as the whole tenor of the chapter is, has the real right of disposal. And he has made it our duty to place some of the property that he has given us, that happens to be in our hands, unto the hand of our brother, not only to provide necessities, a charitable act, but even for the continuation of his business. Against his duty to pay us back a similar sum in a certain time, the money which has been ours at that moment of transition becomes his. So when he's using the money, he's not using our money. He's using his money. God goes ahead and he wants, for whatever reason, a person wasn't born with a bank book. That means we could have said that everybody who was born comes down out of the mother's womb carrying a piece of gold. So everybody has an equal amount of money to begin with. But that would interfere with the purpose of the world. The purpose of the world was for a person, like we said in the beginning, spiritual elevation of his soul, to be more specific, they go into the idea of give and take. Everything is give and take. There's a nosein and a mekabel. Just like you need the one to give, you also need the one to receive. Otherwise, God's will would not be fulfilled. It's like they say a story about one of the great Gedolim, you know, when they used to speak, a Rav only had to speak twice a year, Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Tshuvos, he would give the fiery drush of Shabbos HaGadol, he would speak about the idea of giving Moiz Chitim, helping Nebuchadnezzar the poor. So when he finished and they came home, so his wife asked him, well, was it a successful drush? So he says he believes 50% was accepted. The poor are ready to accept. He doesn't know if the rich are ready to give. So the idea is that both the poor and the wealthy are necessary, the giver and the taker. It's a lot easier for the taker to take than the giver to give. But the giver was given money. He was chosen to be from the givers, a gevir. It's the same letters. He was supposed to be from the givers. So this gevir was given the money. But he could just as well have been from the takers, but there had to be a giver and a taker, so his fate was from the givers. He has blue eyes. It's just that he was chosen for this part. Now, he's keeping it in safekeeping, the extra money that he doesn't need for his livelihood, or that he doesn't deem necessary to invest in property or material and to sell, he just keeps it laying around. This extra money, the Jewish concept, which is a religious concept, it's not an immoral, it's not a question of morality. It's a question of belief, that you believe, really, the money is not yours. If the money is yours, there's no rationale for you not being able to, to use the money to rent out the money, just like you'd sell the cornflakes that you bought for the money. It doesn't matter. But that's only if you accept the money as yours. But if you accept the rationale that the money was given to you with a mission and for a purpose, it's really his money, but we're giving it to you to see if you're going to give the money for your betterment. So then it's already a spiritual purpose. It's a religious purpose, and therefore it's forbidden only as an act of religion among Jews, and it would go both on the giver and the taker. So it's not, you know, those, the anti-Semitic literature always used to jump on this as being one of the points to show you the racist, chauvinistic, etc. attitude of the Jews. But really, it's not that way. It's the performance of a mitzvah of a life's mission, because it's not that we think that there's anything morally wrong. If we really thought that there was something essentially morally wrong in doing it, I don't think they would have permitted a heter iske. I mean, this whole idea of a heter iske, we all take interest basically in a permitted fashion. Now, they wouldn't have permitted this legal fashion if there would have been perhaps a moral wrong involved. But since it was like a religious idea, so therefore they felt that the people, you know, you had to find, like we say, in that aspect, the heter, in order for the people to be able to continue. So that's really Hirsch's point in the idea of the Neshech and the Yomuch Achicha. But there's, on this Pasuk, there's a famous story from the Dumna Magid. On the Pasuk, Yomuch Achicha, in verse 34, when your brother needs your help, so the Medrash says, this is the meaning of the Pasuk, Ashrei Maskil Eldol. Praised is the one who understands Maskil, meaning he knows when a person needs help. He's able to foresee that a person needs help. He says, there are people, he says, that are always going around worried. Even if God has given them great wealth, which would be enough to support them all their days, they won't stop and rest, but they'll just want to accumulate more wealth because they're concerned what'll be next year, and they're concerned also for the future of their children. Now, there are other people who are very happy, all right? And as long as they have what to eat today, they're really very happy. And they go around singing because they have faith in God that he's going to give them what they need tomorrow. Now, sometimes, he says, you'll have people coming to the wealthy people of class one, of the first group, and they'll ask that person, this is a gevir who's always concerned and involved in concentrating on expanding his financial base, and they'll ask him to help someone else, you know, never a person that just asks from day-to-day living. So this person will go ahead and he'll give you a whole drasha that don't worry really, because God is mechem mazon l'chol basar. God will feed you. You have what to eat today. You don't worry about tomorrow. God will feed you. You'll have what to eat tomorrow also, he says. So he says that's not really a true emunah, a true betachin, because if you really believe that way, so why are you conducting your life according to what? To the first character. You should go ahead and you should also do what he does and give your time away for spiritual pursuits. So he says perhaps that's why the Torah puts together first the laws of Shemitah, and then it puts the laws of lending money to a poor person. He wants to tell you the following, that first is to give a person a year's time to work on his own betochon, that see that indeed what happened during Shemitah. And it happens in some miraculous way every 7 years by us, and we don't really, well, we're beginning to taste it a little more, but we don't really appreciate it to its fullest extent, that there is a miracle, there is a blessing. Whatever way it is, the people have enough to eat. So he says, with this betochan, he says, there could be a chashash, maybe there'll be some people who use this betochan when the poor person comes to ask him for tzedakah. So therefore, it says right next to this yet lesson of betochen that you've learned from Shemitah, that if a poor person, when someone comes to ask you for help, don't tell him about Shemitah. You have an obligation, really, to help him. So that's what Dumna Magid said. Both of these laws were placed, really, one next to another, which is an interesting lesson. You can't really be a big tzaddik when you're holding about that.